I guess what I was saying is more that I get this sense from talking to you that there was a certain amount of just natural curiosity and wonder about becoming a scientist for you, and it wasn't like, hey, I can get the Nobel Prize and be really famous control a lot of people and have a big lab, and you know, I could be a lawyer and do this too in a big law firm and become a big partner. You know what I mean? Your ambition about being a scientist seems geared toward knowledge and curiosity versus prestige and money and control, okay?
Yeah, okay, thank you.
And what I'm saying is what you discovered on this educate, well, I think a lot of scientists' initial motivations, okay?
Yeah.
And I stress the word initial. Motivations are that way too, but then you get into this world at MIT. I mean, we're talking one of the highlights or one of the jewels in the crown of American science, right? And here's all this political maneuvering with Nobel laureates, no less.
Well, they're people too. That's one thing you find out.
And so that wasn't, but that wasn't the kind of education we're talking about here that you got from this experience. No increased cynicism or.
Well. Well, that's tough to gauge. Because part of the process of getting your degree, say, getting through graduate school, doing a postdoc, starting your own lab, the process involves becoming more and more practical. And to say that this particular experience in the politics of science was something that
taught you that or helped you,
that made me jaded and, you know, less less, I could even say less interested in the political side of things.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know, it's hard to say.
Do you really think you've kind of run away from that, so that issues of like administration and I mean, I guess as an example, without, again, any particulars, I don't mean to, but just this morning, you're talking with someone on the phone, and there's you know, it's a supplier of something, and, you know, this back and forth, well, you're being given kind of a deal, and you don't really want the deal, you just want the stuff, and what is it worth, and, you know, we'll pay, and can you leave me alone with the rest of it, right? And as you said, now by taking the deal or something, somehow I have to, like, suck up to him, is, I believe, a phrase you use, get that I owe him, that the relationship is not strictly scientific anymore, right? You've got something I need, you're good at it, thank you, here, give it to me. And vice versa, when somebody needs something for my lab to be done, we'll just do it, this is how much it's going to cost you, because this is how much time we spent on it. Do you know what I mean? Versus this other kind of game that you seem to resent to a certain extent.
No, I'm not sure what you mean. I mean,
that seems political as well, it may be at a much smaller level, but it ties you to this person in a way that you really didn't particularly.
I mean, to get back to the issue of recombinant DNA.
Okay, I'm sorry.
I mean, the real issue is what could I accomplish? And, you know, I participated in that, and I participated in it to the extent that I could, but, you know, a graduate student.
Sure.
Doesn't weigh, the opinion of a graduate student in this world doesn't really weigh equally with a learned, established investigator. You know, in sort of the battle of experts.
Mm-hmm.
And so there was a certain amount of just piling up, like on a scale, you know, on a balance.
Mm-hmm.
How many people could you get?
Right, right.
Support your side versus the other side. You know, I think in the politics of science, I mean, there's a certain amount of organization in any political activity. If you organize, you can accomplish something. But just because you organize, it doesn't mean you can accomplish something.
Okay.
Yeah.
I mean, I guess that's what, in a sense...
And it's, if you're trying to learn how to do science, or maybe what I'm saying is at some point I got distracted, that it was just as I got distracted away from the history of science by sort of the idea of doing science. At some point I got distracted by just how hard it is or how interesting it is to do the scientific work.
By the day-to-day kind of, again, politics of it and becoming involved in that.
Well, no, I mean, what I'm saying is that my first instinct was to be involved in the political side of things, you know, a responsible scientist who is looking at the societal impact of his or her work and publicly participating in political decisions that have to do with that.
Mm-hmm.
And my attitude now is
to do more,
much more that it's interesting to do the science.
Mm-hmm.
And that if there's an impact of my work, it's likely to be for example, a commercial impact rather than an environmental hazard. And even that I'm less interested in than
in other words, if something science came along that was, you know, that the UC and its, you know, pretty aggressive marketing and patenting
mm-hmm.
mode came along, and you just kind of hand it over to them and not become involved in, like, the process, and just get on with something else, and or continue that work and let everybody else kind of deal with that part of that.
Well, I mean, some of the work that I did in Eugene is patented,
right.
but it's not earning anybody any money.
Right.
I mean, I think this business that university professors should be in the business of making products is crazy. It's not, that's not what the university is supposed to do or should do. And
there seem to be two ways that universities do it, right? They seem to look out for patentable stuff, and they go ahead and do it and leave the investigator alone, and maybe it'll turn into something, right?
Yeah.
Others seem to be much more aggressive about it, and there seems to even be pressure on the investigators to always keep in the back of their head, boy, this could make us, you know, $25 million a year sort of thing. It's just a piece about the, what is it? Oh, now I can't even remember what it is. At Stanford, right? I guess it's the I don't know. The stuff that...
Cloning.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean,
sure.
And it's good when that patent runs out. And there goes, what, something, an immense amount of money, actually, that Stanford was funding its grad students and whatnot on.
But the number of discoveries at that level are so small. I mean, the University of Wisconsin has a patent on rat poison, basically, that funded...
Yeah.
Research there and funded,
and apparently
to a huge tune.
Apparently, the Johns Hopkins has always been very upset that they didn't recognize what Dan Nathans was doing back when he was doing it, so that they could have patented that and made them, you know, self-sufficient little department there. I guess when I was relating it back to this incident this morning, and I'm sorry, I'm not gonna bring it, you know, begin in that way. I was just talking. I think something along these lines, that stuff gets in the way of just doing it.
No, not at all.
Okay.
It's half the fun.
Okay, so that's okay. It's to be
For you to say, what, did I get jaded or discouraged or cynical about science because of political aspects or learning about political aspects? No, not at all.
It's kind of what...
I mean, I guess I didn't have the need that science be pure and innocent, you know, and the more you do it, the more I do it, the less it has to be a certain way.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know.
And I guess I'm not following completely. You mean the more you do?
I guess what I'm saying is I didn't have a model that science was you know, conducted by gentlemen. And maybe that's in part from reading about the philosophy of science. You know, there are lots of descriptions of how it works. Kuhn, you know, Popper, you name these people. Right. And yeah, I mean, there are just a lot of different styles. Mm-hmm. People have different styles. They have things they're effective at doing. And in terms of success...
Yeah, I guess,
you know, if you have good ideas and do good work, yeah, I mean, there's certainly the politics of marketing and staying funded and
in a sense
and
that
things like that. But I guess I find all that enjoyable. Okay. So
there's none of this, and I think it's still a pretty common notion. It may be more steadfastly held onto and grasped by physical scientists. But, you know, people still do believe that they're uncovering truth, okay? That you're, you know, even if they still understand Popper, you know, they still think that this is an incremental uncovering of layers of confusion, okay? I won't say getting to a final truth, but, you know, an ongoing process that is somehow, you know, you said innocence, but I think you also said purity. The whole entire vocabulary of doing science and, you know, down to even talking about doing purifications and the way we use such words. I mean, we are really talking about an enterprise that has been conceived, at least in the past, as being different than finding out legal truth in a case in a courtroom, okay, which is... always been a matter of who's going to convince.
Well, I mean, it is. It is different. I mean, it's different in the sense that if you repeat a given procedure, you get, you know, basically the same mm-hmm. answer within the error of your measuring capabilities.
Right.
Or if you have a theory,
mm-hmm.
and it's a quantitative theory. You know, the predictions of the theory are the same whether, you know, you run it here or you run it in South Africa mm-hmm. or Swaziland, which is, you know, essentially the other side of the earth
right.
from here, you know.
Mm-hmm.
It's different in that sense, but it's not different in the sense that...
In its conduct.
In its conduct and in the fact that it's a cultural thing. It's mm-hmm. There's a competition of ideas out there.
Kind of a marketplace of ideas, even, I don't know, again, without getting too
commercial
about it all.
It's done by people, and so not only do you have to uncover something, but you have to convince people that it's important or it's real or it's not just what people call an artifact of your measurements.
Mm-hmm.
That it's useful to them, or it's useful to the world to quote think this way.
Mm-hmm.
That
it's explains a whole bunch of phenomena, right?
Well, that's what I mean.
In
by
a nice,
useful.
Neat.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. And you know, there's an aesthetic to it.
You mean to the process of doing it, or to the explanation of it?
No, I mean, there are things that are thought of as beautiful, right? Certain results, or your idea that, your statement just now, that if you formulate an idea that explains a lot of unexplained observations or unconnected facts, that's considered beautiful. You know? Or
like the old unified field theory, right? Which there's the holy grail of physics, so...
Yeah, or the, you know, Fermat's last theorem. I mean, how many people know anything about it?
Right.
But it's in the newspapers when it's solved, and it's more of a, you know, a cultural accomplishment.
Sure.
What is it going to be used for? Nothing. It's like a painting.
Yeah.
You know,
this or a really hard crossword puzzle. Even, I mean, on a completely different level. But again, we do a lot of things in our lives, and
where aesthetic, filling in a crossword puzzle and getting it all right and that sort of thing isn't quote an aesthetic thing or a okay. I didn't mean to get off of your graduates, except that again, these issues seem to crop up as you're learning more and more about science, so that's why we get off on these. And plus, it may seem maybe kind of naive to you. Well, of course, it's done like everything else, or something like that. And yet, it's about repeatable, stable sorts of results. If you can, you know, get the right controls and prove there's no artifacts and that sort of thing, so that it may be something different than just a commercial truth, right? You know, Fruit Loops taste better than, you know, whatever the other things are, because we, you know, we put our recipe together better. And then you take a poll and, you know, 95% of people agree that Fruit Loops are indeed better than God knows what other kind of sugar-coated cereal. But, okay, I just, again, like I said, to me are real important things to get people to talk about. So even if it's a little, like, elementary to you from your perspective.
Oh, no, it's not elementary.
I find it kind
all.
Of fascinating, it's, too.
Yeah, I think when I was reading about different theories and models of scientific progress, to call it that, I mean, even,
no, when
even
I,
the
I
mean, objection
I'm still right.
that there is progress, you know, these were things I think I mentioned in the last tape that really kept me out of the lab to
right.
be confused about these things.
Sure.
And you know, I think the major realization, or maybe you would call it an accommodation if you were less charitable.
No, I'll be charitable.
You know, maybe to be involved, maybe it came in part from this political mm-hmm. involvement on recombinant DNA, and that is that the technology, the view that the technology itself is different from the political decision about what society or a company mm-hmm. or an individual does with that technology.
Right, and we actually did talk about that before on the last tape. On the issue of the responsibility, is it the responsibility of the inventor of the technology or of the users and employers of such technology? In other words, is Oppenheimer, you know, responsible equally as, you know, the Department of Defense? Or is he share responsibility in some other way? And that sort of thing, which are, you know, obviously questions that will be debated and discussed forever, as long as people are... doing such things.
Yeah, but the point is that if you feel that as a scientist, if I felt I was responsible for some use of my work, you know, to make weapons or to harm people or to what? Yeah, hurt people. Destroy society. If I felt I was responsible for that, then I, even if I hadn't thought about it or conceived of it on my own while I was doing the work, then I wouldn't be able to work. I wouldn't be able to do the work. Because what if 20 years from now somebody discovers that they can use my papers to make a weapon, you know, it's like work on the frog visual system was used to make guidance systems mm-hmm. for smart bombs. I don't really consider the people who learned how the frog visual system works responsible for that.
They did not.
On the other hand, I do consider the people who made the bomb guidance system responsible for that, you know, and I would argue that people shouldn't do that.
Right, whereas perhaps Oppenheimer's case versus the guys who worked on the frog visual system is a little more, you know, I mean, he was in a lab making a bomb, or trying to, certainly.
Yeah,
and
absolutely.
So he was taking this kind of esoteric knowledge that he had, or that, you know, again, nuclear fission was certainly an important issue in question regardless of what it was going to do. It certainly became more practically important very quickly in the 30s. But
yeah, but Let's even take that case. So now I'm going to really reveal the depth of my conservatism or something. To develop the atom bomb, right, was an effort to defeat Germany.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a... What? It was a... struggle for survival.
Mm-hmm. It certainly is how it's...
Right.
In general, I mean, I would say I would accept that.
Right. The decision to use it, on the other hand, I think has been criticized probably correctly. Although, the argument on the other side is that it saved a lot of lives. It just didn't happen to be
that
Japanese
inviting,
lives.
Well, and that says something about our own view of I think, perhaps Asian people versus European
right.
people that we made such decisions. But
okay, yeah. So then it was a political decision to go ahead and develop the hydrogen bomb.
Mm-hmm.
And you can make all the you can make lots of statements about the communist menace and the Cold War and the perceived threat that led to that political decision to make this incredible weapon. And now political conditions are different.
Mm-hmm.
And people don't feel that same level of threat. And what you see is success at reversing this decision. There's more success at disarmament, right? Nuclear disarmament. And that's a political process.
Mm-hmm. And all those people at Rand Corporation were right about nuclear deterrence.
Oh, no.
By building more, we'll deter. And to a certain extent, they
so far.
Yep,
yeah.
They've done it. Exactly. Except for, I guess, Pakistan and questions about Iraq and India. There seems to be certainly very little work going forward on making more and new. Not that the research, basic research, isn't continuing, but that the actual production of more advanced weaponry like that, of that sort, is really slowed down or stopped.
Well, I mean, Clinton was just in the news about going to the DMZ in Korea and saying, look, you people are crazy to be building
North Korea's nuclear weapon.
Right, yeah. You are out of your mind. I mean, just try to use this thing.
Yeah.
And, it doesn't even take the having the capacity to destroy the world many times over to deter the use of a single nuclear weapon somewhere. It's
just simple retaliation is a good enough threat, right?
I just hadn't really thought about how simple that idea is.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, so we should get back to graduate school.
Yeah, no, I mean, but this, again, who knows, you were thinking about these things in graduate school, too, as well. But, that was a kind of a time for all this stuff in the beginning of the Reagan era. The first year was all coursework, then... was there some sort of rotational system going on, or had you, that one first year kind of give you an indication of what was going on in different labs? I mean,
yeah, certainly you talked with people, and then during the month of January, the faculty made presentations to the first year students, and then you were supposed to talk to those people and that you were interested in and come to some decision at the end of the spring term.
Mm-hmm.
Instead of doing that, I went to UCSD. That my first January and worked on the development of a low temperature device and low temperature crystallography coupled with a two-dimensional X-ray detector that had been invented at UCSD
by
a physicist named Sung Nguyen, who he was a particle physics guy who
mm-hmm.
had adapted this detector to detect X-rays in two dimensions.
Okay.
And his students had also built, or his lab, his group had also built a low-temperature system, and I was involved in trying to use it and test it.
To get it to make I mean,
to collect X-ray data and low temperatures, and that was a very new thing.
I take it they were using also inorganic. They were trying it on inorganic samples, or this was strictly for biological.
Strictly biological.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, and I had been involved in that
as
an undergraduate, and so.
So,
I settled on a crystallography lab at MIT. Alex Rich, who's most well known, I think, for work on tRNA, the structure of tRNA, and subsequently for DNA structures. I ended up working in his lab, trying to crystallize the nucleosome, the particle in which DNA is organized. But then I ended up getting interested in the problem of secretion. How do proteins get out of cells? And Alex had a senior postdoc in the lab who was working on this problem. And basically I was set to switch to that problem, or I'd started working on that problem when Greg Petsko moved to MIT to the chemistry department. And I saw that as a way to do some interesting crystallography, and so then switched to his lab.
Okay, and there was no, Rich didn't care. I mean, you were still perhaps...
No,
I mean,
Alex has been extremely supportive my whole career. Okay. Interesting guy.
I'd like to cover it more than how you're doing it this way. I mean, it's good to have a summary. You said you went to UCSD in January. You went there for a month? You went there for 6 months?
Yeah, I went there for the month.
Okay.
Yeah, and did experiments that didn't work.
Hate to tell you, but those are interesting to me as the ones that do.
Well, it's pretty interesting, actually.
And even the how reason, you knew about going there and who connected you up, even that kind of stuff.
Greg Petsko, as a graduate student at Oxford, had begun developing low-temperature crystallography of proteins with the idea that this was a way to trap enzymes in action, that if you could cool them enough, you could add productive substrates.
Right.
They wouldn't completely react, and you could essentially take snapshots of catalysis.
And this was his own? I mean, he's sitting in Philip's lab, right?
Right.
Or this is something that's, you know,
all
over Cambridge and,
it was something that David Phillips and had talked with Greg about, and Greg was the person who got it to work and was getting it to work at that time, early to late 70s.
I mean, this is a big kind of breakthrough considering, just the hell that somebody, I mean, you just read the Eighth Day of Creation, the last 250 pages, and Perutz, I mean, just this, I mean, you're talking 40 years almost of, well, no, 30 years, excuse me, of working on the same protein. And I mean, he really... I mean, it's just, it's dogged work, and so I'm just...
Well,
or maybe you don't go all the way back in your head with that kind of sense of the relation to,
I mean,
you know, Kendrew and...
Yeah, the problem with crystallography is that it's a space average and a time average over the crystal and over the time it takes to collect the data. So you can't do real-time experiments. And many biological processes that you want to look at in structural terms happen very quickly. Mm-hmm. And so Greg was, and David Phillips actually, were people who were really concerned with how to use crystallography to get, what shall we say, more relevant information or more useful information. Mm-hmm. And so Greg was working on this in two ways. One was his PhD thesis was on the structure of triosphosphate isomerase. Mm-hmm. And I think it was recognized either by David or by Greg or both or in the lab at the time in the early 70s that here was an enzyme which interconverted two compounds. And so you could add the real substrate in principle to the enzyme. It would bind to the enzyme and it would be converted to the product, but the product was a substrate for the back reaction, so it would just get converted back, and this thing would be going back and forth.
So quickly,
right. And so basically you would, if you determine the structure of such a complex, you would actually get a picture of the average of what the enzyme was doing while it was working. Whereas many enzymes, hydrolytic enzymes that had been studied up to that point by X-ray crystallography, the product didn't bind very well and that reaction didn't really go backwards very well. And so when you added the substrate to the crystal, you might get a complex of the product, but you didn't get a picture of the thing working.
So as to what you're trying to attempting to do with the kind of structural investigations,
right,
you're getting nothing to elucidate function. You're just kind of
right, you
playing
have to guess
around
at the function.
In other words, its whole issue of going into it that way is kind of like not being answered until you can see it,
right,
like
see
in
it
a
working
snapshot.
Yeah. Okay. It's like, you know, maybe the difference between seeing a machine sitting still and seeing it working.
Or seeing, you know, what comes out of the machine and never seeing the machine, perhaps, even. I mean, you know, you could just imagine what makes your automobile or what makes that box come around the, you know, the raisins, right? I mean, and not see the machine and not have any idea, right?
Well,
by
mean,
deconstructing that box of raisins, if you will.
Yeah. The idea was the protein structure gave you a sense of what it was that was doing the job, but not how it did the job. And so Phillips and Greg were very concerned about how to do experiments, you know, just incredible experimentalists, to get information about how that happens. Mm-hmm. And Greg's research is still directed in that, along those lines.
And so still very kind of, you know, based on, again, tinkering and playing around with experimental methods and...
Well, he has very little patience for repeating things.
Uh-huh.
He likes to do new things.
Right.
He
seems to also bounce around.
Nice.
He's at Brandeis now, right? And he's not at MIT or something. I just recently saw some...
Yeah, he moved to Brandeis.
I mean, it's not too far away in a distance, but
yeah,
it's kind of probably like night and day maybe or something. And well, maybe not. I mean, I just...
No, he's still very active. I wouldn't...
Oh, no, I know. I was not implying that it was like retirement or shunting aside from the big time. No. I just... perhaps it was, again, you just described him perhaps a little restless, and he saw opportunities at Brandeis that he didn't have at MIT. You don't want to talk about that anyway.
No, I don't really want to talk about it.
let's move on. If I need to ask, I'll ask Greg Pett.
So, yeah, exactly. anyway, so... I mean, I don't know how to say this. So I went to UCSD and tried to repeat experiments that I had worked on with Greg or Greg had done in Detroit in early 1976 on binding of a real substrate to an enzyme called elastase. And basically we collected the data in San Diego. We did the binding experiment. We did this at low temperature. And the nice thing about the low temperature device in San Diego is that it was much more stable, and you could actually go to lower temperature than the one that we had in Detroit. And so we thought, gee, we're going to be able to repeat the experiment really easily, and then with this two-dimensional detector, we'll get much more detailed information. And in the event, what happened was that every time we collected the data, we could never find the substrate bound to the enzyme. And now Greg has done an experiment that was published, I believe, last year, that basically showed that because we had this better low temperature device, we were cooling the system too much. And the supposition now is that we had cooled it so much that the enzyme couldn't open up and allow the substrate to bind in the active site.
So you were not only maybe slowing it down, you were preventing it from frozen it out. So to
Say. The supposition or the implication of Greg's more recent work is that we had reduced the motions of the molecule so much by cooling it that the substrate just couldn't get in. And so the reason that the experiment worked in Detroit is that our equipment was
not up to speed.
But indeed it was, right?
Yeah, exactly.
Was it Petsko who knew about the San Diego guy?
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
Okay, so, not Fink or...
Oh, yeah, yeah. So
I realized Fink didn't listen to
Crystal. Son called Greg, and Greg said, why don't you get Albert out there? And,
okay. So and he was there. Still at Detroit. Wayne State then, right, when this... Okay.
Yeah. Yeah, anyway, so then I moved to Greg's lab, and he was a new faculty person there in chemistry. He had no equipment, so I came to Berkeley to purify two chemotaxis receptors in Dan Koshin's lab because Greg was interested in chemotaxis.
What was... I'm sorry, his name... You just threw out a name that totally... I did. Dan?
Koshland.
Oh, okay. I'm sorry. Yes, sorry. I know that. You said something else.
So I worked for a month with one of Dan's postdocs and just did a purification and crystallized these two proteins. Okay. And Greg had another student who worked on those for her thesis.
Okay, and that's?
Sherry Mowbray.
Okay, because there's another person, right, I think, out of his lab that she worked with, Fanstock. I don't know what her name is.
Margaret Fanstock was in Dan Koshin's lab.
Okay, okay.
She was a postdoc. We had a great time doing protein purification and learned a lot.
This is all happening the same year?
Yeah, so I switched to Greg's lab, and instead of...
That's not the year of San Diego.
No, that's the next year.
Okay, I'm sorry. We're just doing this for the record, that's
all. Yeah.
Every step of the way.
Then I went to Oxford for the spring.
So you never spent any time in Cambridge?
This was basically the idea that Petsko did not have equipment.
Right,
so
right.
I could work on setting it up, or I could work on science. And he was concerned that I'd go off and get projects started. So I started the chemotaxis work there. Then I decided in that period that I wanted to work on triosphosphate isomerase because I felt I could learn the most crystallography on that project.
Because of the because it had been used before already at Cento? I mean, there was so much to work with, in a sense, or just because Petsko's own expertise with it, or...?
It was an interesting problem, and the way that he wanted to go about it was to solve the structure from scratch.
Okay.
And
that means...
And that's what I wanted to learn, how to do that, okay. How to start with a protein and come up with a three-dimensional structure. So I felt like I could learn all the things I wanted. I felt like the system was interesting. And so because I made that choice, I went to Oxford to Philip's lab. And the goals were to learn my way around the triosphosphate isomerase molecule, the Oxford group, or Greg, when he was in Oxford, had determined the structure of the rabbit muscle enzyme to make heavy atom derivatives of the yeast enzyme crystals that Greg had already grown with Demetrius Cernoglou, to make co-crystals, if I could, with the substrates and inhibitors, and then also to do a low-temperature experiment on lysozyme. And it turned out that the Oxford group had crystallized, I think it was tortoise lysozyme, in a way that the crystals had big channels in them. And so we had thought that we could get the real substrate in and freeze the reaction. And lysozyme was the first enzyme whose structure was determined in Philip's lab in the 60s, early 60s. And they had proposed controversial idea that when the substrate binds to that enzyme, that its shape is distorted. And that's what we had hoped to test by actually getting an X-ray structure of the enzyme substrate complex.
And when you mean distorted, you don't mean the complex is distorted, that the substrate has distorted the enzyme.
No, that the enzyme has distorted the substrate.
Okay, I'm sorry.
Yeah, and it's distorted in such a way that it more resembles the transition state for the reaction, a very reactive form.
And this is a kind of real focus for our question about structure explaining
right.
function.
Right,
okay.
exactly.
All right.
How okay. do enzymes work? Well, one way is they distort.
And they take on this certain...
They distort the shape of the substrate. And so we had hoped to test that, but in the event when I got there, the equipment to do that, the low-temperature equipment, wasn't built. And so I actually worked on building it in the few months I was there. And in fact, we got some of the equipment together. We got the equipment together, but I had to leave before doing the experiment.
I just want to make sure that's not... Yeah, it's still working.
But it was, a wonderful spring in Oxford. learn about British science. I had a friend who was in New College studying political theory, so I went to lectures by Isaiah Berlin, and he took me around. And
your friend or Isaiah Berlin?
No. My friend took me around to his lectures, and
sure.
we went walking in the peaks. And
oh, you didn't take him to your lectures?
No. I lived in a 1,000-year-old building. And graduate dorm.
I did that once. It wasn't 1,000 years old, though.
Yeah, it was fabulous.
You were there. You were there 6 months or so, or
less. Yes, 3 or 4 months, and then I went to China for a couple of weeks with my mom.
Okay, I was going to say, what were you doing in China?
Well, this is fun.
Right. No, with your mom.
My mother worked for Extension at UCLA, and she planned an academic trip.
Wow.
And asked me to go, and Alex Rich had done a postdoc in Linus Pauling's lab in the 50s at Caltech, and so had the person who is the director of the Physical Chemistry Institute at Beijing University.
So
I went there and gave a seminar.
Oh, you did? Okay.
He introduced me to people in Shanghai, so when the, quote, tour went to Shanghai, I gave a seminar in Shanghai. This is 79, so it was...
Pretty much a closed...
Yeah. Well, it was opening up, but it was a time of the Democracy Wall in Beijing, and that subsequently got shut down.
Right.
Mao was being discredited, and it was a politically... thrilling time.
And I mean, you were, because you had this connection, right, through Rich, this guy, I mean, you kind of got a sense, a real flavor for it, instead of being just kind of shuttled around as tourists or as outsiders.
Yeah, and, I met Chinese scientists who hadn't been able to work during the Cultural Revolution, but, who had kept up with the literature, so they knew everything that had been done, even though they hadn't done that much themselves.
In other words, and the foreign literature, too, I mean, they were either sneaking it in, or people were... or maybe they could even have access to it. As long as they didn't do their own work right, they could certainly get a hold of these sorts of things.
Yeah, I mean, it was...
Like structural chemists and biologists?
Yeah, well, there was the insulin group in Shanghai that really...
We're just starting up again after perhaps the...
Yeah, and they had gotten a lot done, and they were
short time.
Right up there in the world in terms of the structure of insulin. But... the group in Beijing was just setting up a crystallography lab, and it was really a bit of an education to go through this building that was sort of dilapidated. And in one corner of it was this fantastically air-conditioned room with people take their shoes off when they go in so it doesn't get dirty. And they had just purchased an X-ray data collection device instrument. And the keyboard had failed. It's a computer keyboard.
Sure.
It failed. And, well, what do you do when the computer keyboard fails? Well, we just call up the company and they send another one. Or you trade it in on warranty. They were looking at the schematics of a keyboard, which I had no idea how a keyboard works. So I got there and they said, could you help us fix our keyboard? I go, no, I don't know.
No.
I have to just buy a
new
one.
I can screw it up more, right? Yeah.
So it was a different...
But they were still doing sin. I mean, that's the lesson you sort of got out. I mean, that they were still accomplishing something.
I mean, how much sort of chutzpah
to bother, right?
Yeah.
When you knew that it was...
Absolutely, yeah. And, I don't know, I met a physicist who had been imprisoned during the Cultural Revolution, and It was a fantastically interesting trip.
Came there are some science. Now, there's an interesting case of the politics of science or whatever, and actually either, it almost seems like the reverse, right? It's the political issues are outside of any kind of scientific issues, but as scientists and as they are whole, they're just being, you know, kind of squelched without any kind of discussion and whatnot. They're still, they have to become politically involved, or they become shopkeepers or, you know, whatever, dependent on somebody else, and just kind of walk away from the whole enterprise, right? I mean, I take it when you say with the cultural imbalance of, I mean, science was just kind of, or certain kinds of science were just considered decadent, right? And products of, like, capitalist thinking, right? I mean, is that what you were getting a sense of, some of these people and their work, or it was just economic?
No, foreign contacts were suspicious. So if you know, science is an international thing, and so people tended to get themselves into political, what you'd call political trouble. They tended to be persecuted for that.
So really it wasn't even a science content issue. I mean, just simply a blanket attack on the side. It was more that their position would lead them to outside contact.
I didn't get to know people enough.
That well.
You know, but certainly as an enterprise, the whole thing was shut down. Experimental biology, you know, stopped. And, you know, it was a time when this was just starting up again in China. And another person I met through a very chance meeting, I met somebody in a post office who was an American whose parents had done a lot of medical work in China, Seidel. And it turns out that he had just graduated from Princeton, and a TA in one of his political theory courses was a good friend of mine.
Uh-huh.
And so he took me to dinner at, he was sort of a character or a special person there because of his parents. So he took me to dinner at...
So he was kind of like accepted part of... I mean, he wasn't looked upon suspiciously, or he had